Studio 360.
This hour on Studio 360, we are playing some of our very favorite stories from 2018. So sit back and grab a cold one.
Bush, as crisp and cold as a mountain stream. It has the same great taste it's always had.
That music you're hearing in this Bush ad was not composed with beer in mind. It was a pre-recorded track sitting on some digital server of a production music company where the ad agency found that music and paid a fee, downloaded it, and put it into their TV commercial. By the way, we listen to that kind of ready-made stock music all the time, and not just in commercials, in movies, on TV, in video games, on radio shows, podcasts, you name it. And we don't realize it. I didn't, certainly. But now I know, because there are some obsessives, of course, who love this kind of background music, anonymous and generic, especially the stock music of the past. And that includes my colleague, Evan Chung, who is here with me in the studio. So what is the correct name for that kind of music?
Well, you can call it stock music or production music. The preferred term is probably library music, because the companies that produce this music, they're called music libraries. And library music is especially the term you'll hear used when talking about what a lot of people think is kind of the artistic heyday, which is basically the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
As so many things are fashionable from that era in so many different genres and media and disciplines.
Well, that's a period where you had some of the best musicians and composers in Europe virtually anonymously creating just thousands of these pieces of music that kind of run the gamut stylistically. They can be catchy or funky and psychedelic. A lot of it is just plain weird and experimental.
Yeah.
And it's almost entirely European at this point. Not very many American libraries.
Was there some special demand for it then? I mean, obviously there were movies and TV shows in the 50s.
Well, in the 60s and 70s is when you see this huge explosion in exploitation filmmaking.
Just really B-movies?
Yeah, B-movies playing at these, you know, grindhouse theaters and drive-ins where they just needed a steady stream of cheap, kind of schlocky genre films. And so they needed cheap music for their cheap movies, and that's where library music came in.
Like spaghetti westerns, obviously that was famously Ennio Morricone, but did those kinds of genre have library music?
Yeah, I can play you some examples of that.
Please.
Well, there's crime dramas. Sci-fi movies, horror films, lots of kung fu movies.
That's pretty cool, actually.
One really big market was porn.
Of course. I think I get why you like this and why people like this. Partly, it's just taken out of context of a film, it's amusing and interesting, right?
Absolutely. And it's funny because it was composed out of context. There was no specific film that they made this for.
Right. So as a collector, do you just download digital versions or are there actual physical LPs?
Well, there were physical LPs produced, but they didn't sell them in stores. The public never saw the records. It was just given to filmmakers as a way to test out the different tracks they might use in a film. So filmmakers would listen to the records, pick out the tracks they liked, call up the library, tell them, I want this song, and pay a fee, and then the library would send over the master tapes.
And they probably pressed very few of those, which probably, I'm guessing, makes them very valuable today.
Right, and nobody knew they existed, really, unless you were in the industry. And they're not very well documented. So every day, people are unearthing new ones, and that's part of the thrill of being a collector of library records.
So these were like music composition factories where composers were just day in and day out composing generic music around a theme. Here, porn today and gangster movie tomorrow. How did that work?
Well, there's a new book out that explains part of how that process worked. It's called Unusual Sounds, The Hidden History of Library Music. It's by this guy named David Hollander, who's a very serious, obsessive library music collector. And he's interviewed dozens of library composers from this era from around the world, including a British composer named Keith Mansfield. He's kind of a superstar of that era of library music. So I talked to Keith Mansfield, this composer, as well as David Hollander, the author of this book. And first I asked David how composers were assigned these themes to compose.
Great. Let's hear it.
Typically, the way it would work is that a library would come up with a brief where they would have a description of given moods that they wanted to create musically, and then they would hand them to a composer and give them really free rein to do whatever they wanted within those guidelines.
And sometimes the briefs were just very general, very almost like bullet point briefs, just the title and a couple of just a sentence describing it.
The label head would say, today we're going to do music for industrial and scientific applications. I want something swelling for the building of a building. Or, you know, following a scientific experiment. I want a track that gives me the feeling of traveling in a train. So it really was about creating soundtracks for films that did not yet exist.
A very easy album to write was an album called Olympiad 2000, which was the first album that Peter Cox got me to do for KPM Library. And that was his vision of an Olympics in the future. The empty stadium, huge stadium, but it was empty. Or then the full stadium with all the activity and energy going on there. Poetry in motion would be something balletic, if you like. Then the rugged endeavor where it's sweating, that sort of thing, that might be the marathon, it might be anything. But things like that would just be triggers for you to get started. And once you get started, you've got to just go with it. You're under pressure because you can't procrastinate. You've got to every day come up with one or two pieces of music. I mean, I've got to get the composition idea, score it for the orchestra, then next day do another one. Sometimes I was doing three in a day. You know, nobody's interested in your excuses. You can't go in there, I didn't feel inspired, so therefore I didn't come up with as much music as I was supposed to. You'd be dead, you know. You'd be out of the business immediately. So it had to be there, done that day, finished that night, whatever, and that made your mind up for you.
I think it was a really compressed time frame. I think that they would walk into the studio and they do a session during the day and then they do a session at night.
Normally, it would be four titles in a three-hour session. That would be the same thing if it was an orchestral session, big band session. You would have the equivalent of a house band where they were the same guys would be on your sessions. In the studio, as much as possible, you're giving them a flavor of what you want, but you don't overwrite. Of course, you've got a composition and you've got the framework and you've got the basic chord structure. But in a funky thing, no, you want to give them as much room for their talent and for their personality to shine in your music. They'd all be in the studio with the strings, everyone there together. You do it all together. And it was, of course, it was great. Complete different world to the one you go in now when you just got yourself and a synthesizer and a computer. There were certain rules in Library. It isn't a film score. That is, you're not given specific timings where things are going to happen and you need to change the mood or go from quiet to loud and things like that, or from slow to fast because there's an action or a fight going on. In live music, you have to start and sustain a mood for however long the recording is. If it's 2 minutes, then you sustain that mood. If an editor wants it to change after 35 seconds, he cuts into another piece of music to do that. What you've got to do, though, is sustain the atmosphere without it just becoming boring.
I think it's important to note that while these composers were toiling away in anonymity, they were not toiling away in obscurity, because while they weren't necessarily named as the composers of this music was really ubiquitous and widely used.
Ah, the start of 2 weeks of top tennis in Wimbledon 85.
The life I had was fantastic. I had so much money, I could go anywhere, no one knew my face. I just loved the fact of being anonymous.
They were happy to eschew the fame of commercial music just in order to keep working. And they were really able to work in a way that commercial musicians are unable to at this point.
Look, I was a commercial arranger for the record companies. I had my own orchestra on CBS Records, but they really wanted you to be one person, the person they were selling. They didn't want you to be all these different people. That wasn't who I wanted to be. I didn't just want to be one part of who I was. With Library, you could write so much different music.
It's as diverse as the spectrum of all musics. So if it exists musically, then there is a Library analog to it. If you wanted, you know, to find a record of South Pacific Islander music, you're going to find a Library record that has that.
I mean, I could write for a huge orchestra, or I could write for just a bass. Whatever I had to do, if I had to write for a 100-voice choir, I'd never done it before, but that's what I would do. It's just one of those skills that you just have an innate sense of what was required, and you could do it.
There is certain kinds of music where there's an inordinate amount of that kind of music. One example of that would be underwater music. There seems to be a lot more underwater records than there are underwater films. The only music that I would say is really not present is vocal music. Library music is overwhelmingly instrumental, but there are a handful of vocal records. There's one by Alan Parker and Madeline Bell, a record called The Voice of Soul. You got what it takes. There is a song on there called You've Got What It Takes. Just a really sweet soul song that shows up in a number of porno films.
You having a good time?
I sure am.
And you still trust me?
Of course I do, Doctor.
I'd meet guys sometimes in the up in Denmark Street, whatever, and they'd say, oh, I saw that movie you did at the weekend. I said, what movie was that? He said, you know, the Scandinavian one. He said, what Scandinavian movie? He said, you know, the one. I said, no idea what they're talking about. What it was, these film producers doing these soft porn films would give credit to the composer. If they used, say, a lot of my music in it, I'd suddenly get the credit for the music. They would just choose from the library, almost like to give their presentation, their film, a little bit of extra kudos, that specially commissioned score. They'd put their name there. Music composed Keith Mansfield. It wasn't just soft porn, but mostly it was porn. But hey, people use music for whatever they want. I mean, it's in our world, we write our music to be used by editors in whatever. We have no moral right on what they use it for.
Become quickly aware of the tracks that are eminently usable because they just work. There are many, many other tracks that are impossible to synchronize. You couldn't even really imagine a possible usage for it. That's library music that I'm especially interested in. There's a composer, for instance, named Giampiero Boneschi. He came to library music much later in life. He was an older guy, and he got his hands on a synthesizer. And he started to make these records of astrato, abstract electronic music. He did one record of sort of like lounge music where he does wordless vocals and electronics. When you listen to it, you think to yourself, how could anyone ever use this in anything? It's just too out there.
There's no point in writing music if nobody's going to use it, because that means we all go broke, because you don't get paid in live music. You do the music, you get paid if it gets used. You get paid by royalties. If they're earning their keep, it's a good library track because its editor found it useful. But they're standout tracks that do the job they were supposed to, but then do jobs that nobody ever dreamed of. And I can tell you, one of my favorite pieces of music was what we used to call industrial music. Now, industrial, when we were doing it in the 60s and early 70s, was big music, sweaty music. It was to do with big industry. It was to do with oil tankers and big machinery and all that sort of thing. So the music was large scale. One of the guys I always admired, a guy called Johnny Pearson, he wrote a piece of music called Heavy Action. So this piece of music called Heavy Action did that perfectly, but it got picked up. So Heavy Action has been used in America for over 40 years as the Monday Night Football theme, and it sounds great. But it wasn't written for football, it was written to be an industrial piece of music. Now, when I say that's a great piece of live music, that's because it did the job it was supposed to do originally, which was to be the industrial music, but it had something else as well, which took it into uncharted territory, and it's so famous because of it.
Themes International has two records that I think are very much of note, called Drama Suite Volume 1 and Drama Suite Volume 2. Those two records of Alan Tews are absolutely superlative records. And there's a track called The Big One that everyone in the world at this point would recognize as the theme to The People's Court. I'm finding out about library LPs I've never heard of every single day. I just think the idea that there's this massive pile, this mountain of music out there that really no one's really scratched the surface of is interesting to today's music listener. I mean, honestly, it appears to be endless.
The whole thing about the live music, it may not have had the glamour of being a film composer or of being a pop star or whatever, but that's not what I wanted. I mean, I just wanted the opportunity to be all the different people I could be as a composer. I could be serious, I could be humorous, I could be evil, I could be nice and innocent, I could do angry music, I do all sorts of things. So that was very fulfilling as a composer, and it kept me interested for my whole musical lifetime.
You can read David Hollander's interviews with Keith Mansfield and some of his fellow ubiquitous, unheralded composers in his book, Unusual Sounds, The Hidden History of Library Music. The book also reproduces some of the great library music album covers, which are really all the more lovable given that the records weren't even meant to be sold. Studio 360's Evan Chung produced our story.